Welcome to the KSTE Farm Hour. Here's KSTE's Farmer Fred, Fred Hoffman.
There's about 25 million acres of farm and ranch land in California. Which commodity utilizes the most acreage? It's almonds, and more almond trees are going in the ground in the Golden State. We have the numbers. You know, it's hard to say which is flowing faster right now, water from California's dams or lawsuits to stop the flow of water from dams intended for California's farmers. We have the latest news on that front, and we dive into a sea of garbanzo beans, a crop that is also enjoying an increase in acreage here. We have all that, crop reports, the extended weather, and hey, what about using robots in meat processing plants? Ain't gonna happen. It's all coming up on this week's KSTE Farm Hour. Let's get started. Well, the big keep getting bigger. We're talking almonds. And California's 2019 almond acreage is estimated at 1.5 million acres. That's up 10% from the 2018 acreage of 1.3 million acres. Of the total acreage for 2019, 1.1 million acres were bearing, 350,000 acres were non-bearing. Preliminary bearing acreage for 2020 is estimated at 1.2 million acres. The leading almond variety is Nonpareil, followed by Monterey, Butte, Carmel, and Padre. So who are the big almond-growing counties in California? Kern, Fresno, Stanislaus, Merced, and Madera were the leading counties. Those five had 72% of the total bearing acreage. Spray time is approaching for almond orchards throughout the state of California in order to thwart an invasion of the navel orange worm. The key is to look for almond hull split. When growers start seeing those almond hulls splitting towards the top of the trees, that's the time to take action. The key point is don't wait too long to start hull split spraying. That's going to cost you, and so will a poor spray job. And UC Cooperative Extension Farm Advisor Franz Niederholzer, who advises almond growers in Colusa, Sutter, and Yuba counties, it's not those two factors alone. It's also the time of day you spray is very important.
Yeah, we did a study a few years back. You know, in June in the Sacramento Valley, and I'm sure the same for the San Joaquin, the air is really dry once you get past, you know, 85, 90 degrees, which can happen pretty early or early in the day. Not 11:30 noon, something of that nature. The air is dry, and you're spraying with small droplets. You've got a remarkable amount of evaporation, and once the droplets get small and evaporate quite a bit, then they don't land as well, and you end up with this dramatic drop off in coverage. Which that 50% was measured. We took leaves and measured the amount of material we sprayed out. We knew how much we sprayed out, and you know, there was a 50% loss in deposition of material in the upper canopy, which is, as you say, it's a remarkably high amount. Considering you pay for that stuff, then it's gone. The reduction in evaporation is better for your operators. It's night spraying early, you know, into the early morning, you know, basically 10 p.m. to 10 a.m., roughly that window, is much more effective as far as deposition goes than the other 10 a.m. to 10 p.m.
Niederholzer points out that dusk to mid-morning is a good target window, and some aerial applicators are also set up for night spraying.
The Farmers to Families Food Box program is designed to get excess meat, dairy, and produce to families facing shortages of food. Megan Nelson is an economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation and says, now that the contracts have been announced, the Food and Nutrition Service will take over and get food to those in need.
They're going to manage the food and nutrition assistance programs. This is what they normally do under their purview at USDA. And now they're going to be looking into the qualified recipients of various USDA food programs and coordinating those purchases with food banks in need.
Not only will these purchases get food in the hands of people who need it, this will also help American farmers deal with extra commodities sitting in storage or being destroyed.
These purchases releases from USDA are really going to help in removing the excess supply from the market. And this is a benefit that really ripples across the supply chain to help improve commodity prices and help out U.S. farmers and ranchers.
Nelson says the commodities that will benefit the most from the program are some of the most perishable.
$461 million are going to go to fresh fruits and vegetables, with $317 million in a variety of dairy products with a focus on fluid milk, and $258 million are going to meat products, with another $175 million in a combination of fresh produce, dairy, and meat produce boxes.
Chad Smith, Washington.
Politico's Morning Agriculture reports that multi-million dollar food bag contracts are going to unknown names. The Agriculture Department's plan to distribute boxes of surplus food to people in need has led to multi-million dollar contracts going to companies that appear to have very little experience working with food banks or farmers. Among the recipients are an event planning company in San Antonio, Texas, known for throwing lavish weddings and high-end conferences, a company that sells hand sanitizers, lotions, and other wellness products in airports, and a California firm that offers business finance solutions. Well, food industry companies have been quietly grousing about whether some of these recipients can pull off the task of buying up a variety of perishable food items, then packing them in easy-to-distribute boxes, and then providing the boxes to food banks and other nonprofits where people in need can pick them up. Politico reports that some big-name food businesses like Sysco did not receive any contracts.
Turning beef cattle into cuts of beef takes a lot of hands-on labor, and events of late have some people asking, well, could robotics be used more in meat plants?
Now, prior to becoming a university professor, I was the research manager for Smithfield Foods, and we tested a lot of that type of technology.
That's Ty Lawrence, a professor at West Texas A&M, and he says it sounds cool. Sounds like it ought to be easy to do, replace some meat plant workers with robots like they do in car factories.
But it's not quite that simple.
In a car plant, each run of each car is the same, same size, shape, perfect for robotics. But in a beef plant, each carcass is different size, shape, weight, infinite number of variables.
That the human is working through on a real-time basis, and I'm extremely skeptical that we can add enough robotic technology to remove more than maybe 10% of the labor force.
And so Lawrence says meat processing will likely stay
a very labor-intensive, hands-on process.
Gary Crawford, reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Let's take a look at the weather for the southern Sacramento and northern San Joaquin Valley for the period of May 19th through the 25th, according to AccuWeather. It's going to start off a bit rainy and a bit cool on Tuesday, with a high of 71 and a low of 52. Other than that, for the balance of the week, it's sunny skies, but temperatures a little bit below normal, warming up to near normal by the weekend. So highs will start off in the mid-70s and warm up to the low 80s by Friday. Overnight lows, for the most part, will be in the mid-50s. And according to AccuWeather, it's sunny skies all the way through the end of the month.
The latest nationwide topsoil moisture numbers indicate
13% surplus nationally and 20% very short to short.
No change week over week in the very short to short category, and a 2% drop in topsoil surplus totals from the previous week, according to USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
In terms of the areas that remain on the wet side, there is certainly a pocket across the interior south. That wetness extends into the middle Atlantic and northeastern states. We also continue to see some pockets of wetness across the Midwest.
Whereas topsoil moisture shortage overlapping agricultural areas is most notable in the southern half of the Great Plains.
70% topsoil moisture very short to short in New Mexico, 63% in Texas, 52% in Colorado, and 44% in Kansas.
Plus additional topsoil moisture shortage concerns in Northern California and the Pacific Northwest, as well as Florida. I'm Rod Bain, reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Here's this week's California crop report. In Tulare County, winter planted wheat, oats, and barley is maturing. In other areas, winter small grains, including wheat, were being harvested for silage. Winter wheat was being cut and dried for hay. Alfalfa continues to be cut, dried, and baled as well. Rice planting is continuing in the Sacramento Valley. Stone fruit set appeared to be of good quality. Immature fruit proceeded to develop. Early varieties of apricots, cherries, peaches, nectarines, and plums were harvested. Apples and pears progressed. Grapevines continue to bud at a faster rate due to recent warm weather.
Valencia orange, lemon, lime, tangelo, and pomelo harvest remains consistent. Mandarin harvest continues with export market demand fluctuating. Remaining seedless tangerine groves were covered with netting to prevent pollination. Olives were pruned. Strawberries were progressing well due to the warmer weather. Blueberries continue to be harvested and shipped for domestic and export markets. Orchard maintenance continues. New nut orchards were prepped for planting. Almond orchard floors were treated with herbicides where necessary. Walnut and pistachio growth continues unaffected by recent rains. Tomatoes for processing continue to be planted, especially here in the southern Sacramento Valley. The asparagus harvest continues. Tulare County reported spring and winter vegetables were harvested and sold at farmers markets as well as local roadside stands. Summer vegetable crops continue to be planted and have developed well with the warmer temperatures and adequate rains. Down in Imperial County, onions are progressing well. Rangeland grasses and forbs were flourishing. Foothill rangeland and non-irrigated pasture were reported to be in good to excellent condition. Movement of cattle to higher elevation pasture land continues. Don't forget, the KSTE Farm Hour is available on your schedule. You can listen to it live, of course, at 6:50 on the AM dial here in Northern California, or stream it live via the iHeartRadio app. And, of course, the KSTE Farm Hour is available as a podcast. Download it from your favorite third-party podcast aggregator, and that includes the iHeartRadio app, Apple Music, and Google Play. Okay, time for a quick quiz. What are the leading wine grape varieties grown in California? What is the leading table grape variety grown in the Golden State? I'll have that for you in just a second. But first, let me tell you about California's 2019 grape acreage. It totaled 918,000 acres. Of the total grape acreage, 860,000 were bearing, while 58,000 were non-bearing. The wine-type grape acreage is estimated at 635,000 acres. Of the total acres, 590,000 were bearing, 45,000 were non-bearing. Table-type grape acreage totaled 130,000 acres, with 121,000 bearing and 9,000 non-bearing. For raisin-type grapes, they totaled 153,000 acres, of which 149,000 were bearing, 4,000 non-bearing. Okay, so who are the leading wine grape-type varieties grown in California? The leaders? Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon. Among table grape varieties, Flame Seedless leads the way. And for bonus points, you may already know which is the leading raisin-type variety. That would be Thompson Seedless. It's utilized for raisins, fresh market, concentrate, and wine.
California's agriculture industry continually worries about potential drought and potential impacts to crops and livestock. Drought of recent years led producers to pump groundwater to irrigate crops and orchards. Concerns about reduced groundwater supplies led the state of California to issue regulations designed to create sustainable use of groundwater and replenish aquifers. Yet,
that is going to curtail growers, because when we had this highest drought in 2014, what they did was to go to groundwater pumping. But in the future, that insurance policy will not be there. So how do you deal with those conditions?
And that has led University of California Davis Associate Professor Isaiah Caseca and others to look to innovation to find ways to irrigate crops with less water while improving yields. Speaking at this year's USDA Foster Our Future event, Caseca says research surrounding two of the Golden State's most valuable crops, almonds and alfalfa, has developed some water efficiency strategies. For instance, the significant growth in California's almond industry.
In 2018, we had almost 1.4 million acres of almonds, and they were valued at about $5 billion.
Not only means more acreage, but production shifting from prime to marginal lands. One tool being developed in water efficiency is zone irrigation management, based on similarities in soil types and water holding capacity.
And the idea is to group these irrigation zones in the soils that are relatively similar so that you can better manage your irrigation run times and your irrigation duration.
Innovative technology then is used to develop routine irrigation schedules in each zone to improve efficiency both within zones and throughout the entire almond field. Similar study on water efficiency in alfalfa crops led Caseca and colleagues to develop a new irrigation technique.
Called mobile drip irrigation, where we remove sprinklers and replace them with drip because we know drip applies water much more efficiently than sprinklers.
This mobile equivalent shares similar benefits to drip irrigation, including
much better soil water storage compared to low elevation sprinklers.
Kaseka adds increasing water efficiency in alfalfa production is essential, not just to forage growers, but to another major California ag industry, dairy.
To prevent dairies from leaving the states to go to other areas.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
It's hard to say which is flowing faster right now, water from California's dams headed for farmers in central and southern California, or the number of lawsuits and judicial rulings related to water that are filling the courthouses right now. The Sacramento Bee reports a federal judge in Fresno has blocked the Trump administration's plan to pump more water supplies through the Delta. The judge, sided with Governor Gavin Newsom, ruled the increased pumping would harm the very fish species Trump likes to mock, and that would be the Delta smelt. The preliminary injunction issued last week by U.S. District Judge Dale Drozd only runs through May 31st unless it's extended, but it demonstrates the legal roadblock state officials can throw in the Trump administration's way as he tries to overhaul California's elaborate water system to deliver more supplies to farms and cities south of the Delta. And that ruling will create immediate impacts on water supplies for California's farmers. Farm irrigation districts in the San Joaquin Valley, their supplies already curtailed by a dry winter, will lose an estimated 52,000 acre-feet of water this spring. And lawsuits are flowing as well. 17 states and two major cities sued the Trump administration in early May over a new rule that eliminates anti-pollution safeguards for a large portion of waterways in the United States. It's the Navigable Waters Protection Rule. It was finalized on April 21st. It revamps the prior Waters of the United States rule enacted under the Obama administration in 2015, which included protections for wetlands, artificial lakes and ponds, and ephemeral streams, critical waterways that carry stormwater runoff. The new rule, enacted by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of the Army, classifies those bodies of water as non-jurisdictional and exempts them from anti-pollution safeguards under the Clean Water Act. California Attorney General Javier Becerra and New York Attorney General Letitia James are leading a coalition of the 17 states and two cities in challenging that regulatory rollback. They claim the Trump administration disregarded scientific evidence, failed to fully consider the impact on water quality, and interpreted Waters of the United States in a manner inconsistent with the Clean Water Act. The EPA disagrees. A spokesman said the agency and the Department of the Army believe that the Navigable Water Protection Rule will stand the test of time as it is securely grounded in the text of the Clean Water Act and is supported by legislative history and Supreme Court case law. Congress, in the Clean Water Act, explicitly directed the agencies to protect navigable waters. The Navigable Waters Protection Rule regulates these waters as well as the core tributary systems that provide perennial or intermittent flow into them.
USDA is investing millions of dollars to provide broadband service in unserved and underserved rural areas around the country.
These are very vitally important programs, and we want to do our best at USDA to make sure that we're getting the best value for the dollar.
Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue announced awards to companies serving rural residents in Oklahoma, Kansas, and New Hampshire as part of the ReConnect pilot program.
USDA plans to continue to work to ensure all Americans that we possibly can reach ensure they have access to high-speed broadband connectivity.
Chad Roop, the administrator of USDA's Rural Utility Service, highlights four new ReConnect projects worth $71 million.
To build over 800 miles of fiber to the premises for 4,200 households. All four projects are located in Oklahoma, and one also serves Kansas. These projects include service to the Osage, Pawnee, and Cherokee nations.
He explains why the program is necessary.
These services are ideally suited for the ReConnect program as providers deliver new opportunities for precision agriculture, distance learning, telemedicine, advanced manufacturing, and opening new markets for small businesses.
Jill Keeney is with one of the awardees, Ken Okla Schidler.
We specialize in rural and we specialize in fiber since we're a longtime provider out here and we live and work out here. And we know the expense of connecting all of these rural populations with very low density.
The company covers four counties in Kansas and six counties in Oklahoma.
These beautiful Flint Hills areas are full of cattle ranches and oil fields, along with families, teachers, and students that have been needing high-speed connection for a while.
USDA also is investing $2 million in high-speed broadband in rural New Hampshire. Susan Rand King is president of awardee Granite State Communications. The company has spent a decade working to replace its copper network with fiber optics, at least for the majority of its customers.
The remaining areas are our most rural and most expensive to reach. This USDA Reconnect loan will allow us to bring fiber to those customers in Washington, Deering, and Hillsboro.
The loan will help the company provide high-speed internet accessibility to 890 households as well as to a community facility.
The pandemic has emphasized how important broadband is to households and businesses, and the timing of this loan couldn't be better.
Meanwhile, Roop has details about the overall Reconnect program.
In the first round, we had a significant oversubscription. We had $600 million in budget authority available, and I believe we had $1.4 billion worth of requests.
And for the second round,
that just closed on April 15th, we had 172 applications from 42 states and from Puerto Rico as well. That was for a total of $1.57 billion. It just goes to show that the demand is extremely high.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
How bad is rural broadband here in California? So bad that farmers in third world countries have faster down and upload speeds than we do here in California if you live in the country. That's according to Robert Gore. He's with the Gualco Group. He's also with the Pro Bono AgTed Roundtable. They're an advocacy group organized to bring higher broadband speeds to rural California.
It became apparent that the infrastructure cost was dropping dramatically. I'm talking about the towers and other things. You can actually get a tilt-up tower on the back of a Jeep and do line of sight now that you couldn't do before. This comes ironically again from Africa, where one of our friends, a professor, went there to do a broadband project, and he came back and said, you know, the broadband quality in rural California is worse than it is in a third world country. And then he said a memorable statement. He said, the information highway in rural California is a rutted dirt road. And he's right.
Gore wants to remind rural Californians this is the time to be speaking to your elected representatives to get economic development in rural areas of California, which includes broadband. Remember, it is an election year. According to the latest statistics from the California Department of Food and Agriculture for 2017-2018, notable increases in California production have included dried plums, sweet cherries, and garbanzo beans. Garbanzo beans? Yes, indeed. In fact, the acreage has increased quite a bit. Back in 2008, there were 6,300 harvested acres in California of dry garbanzo beans. In 2017, that jumped up to 13,600. And the yield per acre has gone up quite a bit, too, from 1,840 pounds in 2008 to 2,130 pounds in 2017. Quite impressive. Are garbanzos in your future? Well, University of California tends to think so. They have a new publication out that you may want to check out called The Garbanzo Bean Production in California. It's publication 8634. And we're talking with the lead author of that new manual for growing garbanzo beans in California. She's Rachel Long, UC Cooperative Extension Farm Advisor for Sacramento, Solano, and Yolo County. And garbanzo beans, it's probably best known as something you buy in a can, but there is a growing market for fresh garbanzos, isn't there?
Yes, a lot of people like the garbanzos that are green, so that, you know, just the green beans that are in the pod. And those are really tasty just for eating or garnishes on salads as well.
Probably the one processed version of garbanzos, also known as chickpeas, that people may be familiar with is hummus.
Right. Well, here in California, we actually grow the really large creamy colored garbanzo bean or chickpea that's used as garnishes for salads. So California grows roughly, you know, about, as you mentioned, about 13,000 acres of garbanzo beans now in California. And it is, these beans are destined for canning or dry packaged for use in high-end markets, like in salad bars, really super tasty and very, very nutritious. In other areas of the United States, like, for example, up in Washington State, That's where the garbanzos are grown for basically processing into hummus. And that's a much smaller bean that's grown. And there's under rainfall conditions, and that's all sent back east essentially for processing into that Sabra hummus that we see in our grocery stores and enjoy so much.
From your publication, I read that garbanzos are primarily grown in four climate zones in California. What are they? What do they have in common?
Well, the neat thing about garbanzo beans is they're actually a winter crop, and so they're generally planted about December, January, and sometimes into February, and then they grow during the cooler months of the year, and then they're harvested in the summertime. And at one time, a lot of our garbanzo bean production was actually on the coast because they do like that cooler climate. So down in Santa Maria, San Luis Obispo area, but then that area actually became an area for planting really high value crops like grapes, and so production for garbanzo beans has then since like the 1990s has actually moved inland into the Central Valley, and so some big growing areas for garbanzo beans would be in the Sacramento Valley and also the San Joaquin Valley down by west side Los Banos area.
Are there varieties of garbanzos that do better here than they would on the coast?
Yeah, we have. There's just been a really big breeding program through UC Davis where we're constantly developing varieties of garbanzo beans that are high yielding and a very, very large seed that doesn't crack or split during canning, so that you do have a high quality bean for the canning quality market and garnishes for salads, and so these varieties are well adapted to the Central Valley conditions as opposed to say on the coast where you might have more fog, and so the ones that we grow now are very, very well adapted to the Central Valley conditions.
Because it is a winter cool season crop that fixes nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
Is the world of carbon credits involved in growing this?
So that's sort of a whole different area in terms of carbon sequestration, and there is a tie-in because of course nitrogen is associated with issues of carbon sequestration, and the garbanzos actually fix a lot of their own nitrogen needs. And so you can actually grow the crop with less nitrogen inputs than other crops, and get really good yields. And that's why I think that garbanzos is just such a great fit for our cropping system, because they're grown in the wintertime and so very highly dependent upon rainfall. And that's free and free water, and then also you have a few inputs such as nitrogen in growing the crop, and that all reduces the cost and the inputs needed for growing garbanzos. And so I always consider it like a green crop, in that it's just a high high protein and really good for our health, and also good for the soil. And a low input crop.
Another low input of garbanzo beans, it's a fairly an all mechanized crop. Very little hand labor is needed.
Exactly. That in the planting of these garbanzo beans, it's all mechanical. So you've got mechanical seeders that go in and plant the beans and the crop. And then for harvest, we actually use grain combines. And so it's harvested just like you'd be harvesting a wheat crop for the seed, and that mechanization certainly cuts down on labor costs as well.
Here in the Sacramento and San Joaquin Valleys, for the garbanzo growers, what can they follow that crop with, seeing how it isn't harvested till June or July?
Right. So then after you harvest your garbanzo crop, then you can go in and plant a winter crop like wheat or any other cereal grain or triticale. Or you could put in alfalfa following a garbanzo bean crop. So So you're not, you're not limited in your crop rotation. There's plenty of options for crops following a garbanzo crop.
Well, I imagine what a lot of California farmers want to know, though, is, well, that's all well and good, but can I make money growing garbanzos?
You know, the good news is that the price of garbanzos, the beans is going up, and we have UC Ag and Natural Resources and UC Davis, but we're constantly doing work on developing new varieties of garbanzo beans that are resistant to pests and diseases with high yields and large seed size, and that really fit this niche market that we have for producing garbanzo beans for the canning industry and for those high-end markets like salad bars. And California, just, we have the right growing conditions for producing a really high-quality bean with, hot, dry summers and winters with, and this year in particular, with plenty of water for production, few nitrogen inputs, that all mechanization of, harvesting with a grain combine, that all reduces the cost of that production. And we just meet the market needs for growing this high quality bean.
With a growing market of farm to restaurant, many smaller farmers are basically growing for restaurants. Are garbanzos adaptable to a smaller farming operation?
Yeah, definitely. Either large or small. The big issue is for harvesting beans on these small farms is that you really have to have the equipment for harvesting those beans. And so if and buying a combine, for 10 acres is just not realistic. But that said, that oftentimes if you can work with a custom grain harvester person that can come in and do that harvesting, I think that then there is a opportunities for definitely growing and marketing these the garbanzo beans at even at a smaller scale level.
You mentioned that University of California has developed garbanzo bean varieties with higher yields. What are some of those?
Well, so UC Pegasus, P-E-G-A-S-U-S, and UC Vega, V-E-G-A, are two varieties that have been most recently released through the UC Davis dry bean breeding program. And these are two varieties that are now just getting out on the market that really are good yield producers and high quality beans in terms of that it's good for canning, and as I say, the canning market is really what brings in the most money for garbanzo beans, and in terms of that really high quality niche market that anybody around the world can grow the bean for processing, like into flour or hummus, but there's very few areas in the world that can grow this high quality bean like we can. And that's our market, that niche market that we're going for, which has the higher value product.
We're talking with Rachel Long, UC Cooperative Extension Farm Advisor for Sacramento, Solano, and Yolo County. And it's been a 30-year project putting together their latest release, Garbanzo Bean Production in California. You mentioned that the irrigation needs for garbanzo beans could almost be left to what falls from the sky. And I could see that being true in the Sacramento Valley, but the further south you go, I would think there would have to be some irrigation.
Right. That definitely, if you are growing in an area where you just don't have enough rainfall, then you definitely need to irrigate. Garbanzos are going to require probably a total of 20 inches of water. And so if you are in an area that, say, in the South San Joaquin Valley, where you might only get, 4 or 5 inches, then you definitely need to irrigate. So sometimes garbanzos are grown on basically drip irrigation or flood. But the neat thing about garbanzos is they've got this deep tap root, and they, they're pretty tolerant to fairly dry conditions, and that, those plants will just mine the soil for water, and so they're pretty resilient. But for high yields, you're definitely going to need need water, but they can. They're also really good with mining water from the soil profile.
Anytime I hear that a crop doesn't require much water, I my mind thinks of the reverse. It probably suffers if it's waterlogged soil.
Yeah, if too much water, of course, is bad for garbanzos too, as it is for any crop. And we've had some issues in the past with garbanzo production in wet years, in terms of especially like submoisture, that if you've got, you know, that too much water, especially, you know, underneath the soil surface, that you can get yield declines. I think that a couple of years ago when we had a really, really wet year and all the dams were overtopping, I think there was probably maybe about a 20% yield loss in some areas where you just had too much submoisture underneath the ground. So you do want to really be careful with garbanzo beans in terms of where you plant them. You don't want to plant them in an area that floods or where you have a really high water table, because those roots go deep. And so in a dry year, you know, the roots will go down. But if it's a wet year, the roots grow down and then the water comes up and they just sit, the roots sit in water. And so that could be an issue for production.
And I imagine there are diseases associated with that. Things like a disease I've never heard of before, charcoal root rot.
Charcoal root rot, yeah. So there are definitely root rot diseases that are a problem for garbanzo beans. If you're growing in soils that are really heavy and saturated with water, I think the most limiting disease that we have in garbanzo beans is actually a foliar disease, one that attacks the leaves and the stems, and it's called Ascochyta blight. It's a fungus that. In some years, in wet years, it can just be really bad, and it can take that plant down. So we do have varieties. These two new ones that we released, UC Pegasus and UC Vega, that these do have some resistance to that Ascochyta disease, helping to manage it. It can really be problematic, and it's just something that you do have to watch for, particularly if you're growing organically, because there's really not a lot that can be done to control that disease once it hits. But it's actually it can be controlled through planting certified seed, which means that, you know, you buy seed that you know has been growing under conditions where there's no disease, because it's spread by seed. So you're planting clean seed. And of course, then there's seed treatments, and then there's foliar fungicides if needed that help control this disease. But that truly is one of the most limiting issues for growing garbanzo beans, particularly for organic growers, is managing and controlling that disease, because I've seen where it can reduce yields, you know, by like, you know, 50%. So it's a problem that needs to be monitored.
Are garbanzo beans affected by certain pests that might affect other bean varieties, like cutworms or wireworms? And if so, how do organic growers get around that?
Oh, so, you know, so the neat thing about garbanzo beans is that they actually secrete an acid. It's called malic acid and prussic acid, and it just oozes from those leaves. And that's actually a really good natural defense compound against most insect pests. So, for example, aphids might land on a garbanzo plant, but they will not breed on garbanzos. They'll just die because of those acids that the plant secretes. And so sometimes, you know, when you're walking through a garbanzo field, you know, some people are really sensitive to those acids. So when I'm handling garbanzo beans, I actually prefer to wear gloves, just because I don't like that sticky residue on my hands. But for the most part, the neat thing about garbanzo beans is that they can really resist a lot of insect pests because of these acids that are secreted by the leaves.
I would think, though, that resistance is best when the plant has a certain height to it, a certain development to it. But what about seedlings of garbanzos?
You know, probably the worst pest of garbanzo seedlings would be the seed corn maggot. And it's a fall planted and, you know, early winter planted crop. And if it's slow growing, then it is. That seed is really susceptible to pests and diseases, seedling diseases like pythium or root rot, and so it's most vulnerable to these little seed corn maggots, which are little flies. So as long as you plant kind of after the flight of the seed corn maggot, which oftentimes is, you know, it'd be in the fall and the spring, And so those winter planted when those bugs aren't there is going to really help out in terms of stand establishment.
Anything else you want to add to this?
Just that that garbanzo beans are just really, really good for health. They've got, you know, great protein and vitamins and minerals, and they're just really good on salads. And so this coming summer, just enjoy them and know that that they're actually grown here in California, so you're buying locally as well.
The name of the publication is Garbanzo Bean Production in California. It was released in March by University of California Cooperative Extension, UCANR, and you can find it online. It's a free publication, publication number 8634. We've been talking with the lead author of that publication, Rachel Long, UC Cooperative Extension Farm Advisor in Yolo, Solano, and Sacramento counties. Rachel, thanks for the good news about garbanzo beans.
You're welcome, and good talking with you.
If you think Asian giant hornets are poised to become the nation's next most wanted pest, the reality is much less sensational.
In December 2019, USDA confirmed the detection of a single Asian giant hornet in Blaine, Washington, and Washington State University identified a second Asian giant hornet later the same month.
That was Anne LeBrun with USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service.
Although there are a number of unconfirmed Asian giant hornet sightings from the public, neither USDA nor Washington State Department of Agriculture has any evidence that Asian giant hornet populations are established in Washington or anywhere else in the United States.
She adds that unconfirmed sightings may be lookalike hornet species.
The Washington State Department of Agriculture is surveying the state for the pest. Should the Washington State Department of Agriculture locate any Asian giant hornet nest, they will respond quickly to eradicate them.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks for listening to the KSTE Farm Hour, heard every Sunday from noon until 1 p.m. Pacific Time, and available anytime as a podcast at KSTE.com.